changing and every day looks like rain. But I keep hoping for that sun. The streets are filled with demons, Lord, that's never gonna change. But I still wanna be with everyone. I know there's something for you.
It's 4:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the track In This Life by the Canadian band The Strumbellas. More from them in just a bit. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a governmental affairs expert about the likelihood of November's governor election being decided in the courts, given all the lawsuits going on about election proceedings here in Wisconsin.
First, there are lots of different ways to describe the Strumbellas' sound. Roundtable Radio said it's what would happen if Mumford & Sons joined forces with Arcade Fire. As a genre, they've been called folk pop grass, blending traditional sound with pop and bluegrass.
They won one of Canada's biggest honors, the Juno Award, this year, and the SiriusXM Indies Award for Folk Group of the Year. They're in Wisconsin tonight at the True Coffee Performance Space in Fitchburg at 8 p.m.
Simon Ward and Isabel Ritchie join us now in studio. Simon's a songwriter, vocalist, and guitarist, and Isabel plays violin. Simon, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me and us.
Isabel, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Well, we came in with that song. That one's called In This Life. Simon, what can you tell us about that one?
Well, first of all, it tripped me out because I haven't heard it since I recorded it like a year ago. So I was just listening going, oh, man, I forgot.
Remember that?
Yeah, it was just it was a song we did It's actually funny. It's the only hopeful song we've ever written as a band. Everything else is a bit doom and gloomy, and that's like our one song that's just like, don't worry, there's something good for you out there.
Even though, you know, you said the rest of the album is more doom and gloomy, there's something optimistic about it anyway, the sound of it. It's sort of like the lyrics might be doom and gloom, but the sound is sort of hope.
Yeah, it's kind of keep it fun. I kind of got that idea from Shannon Hoon from Blind Melon. I really like that concept of kind of dark and sad lyrics with fun, happy music. So I tried that out.
Well, Isabel, I want to go to you now. You know, in digging around about how to describe what the Strumbellas is, I came across the term folk pop grass. How would you describe your sound? Is that right? Folk pop grass?
Yeah, we always have fun with what other people describe us as. We've gotten like goth folk and regular alt country, and we get compared to some pretty funny bands. I think that's, you know, folk pop grass. I think Simon maybe coined that term.
Nice. Well, Isabel, you joined the Strumbellas after you actually saw an ad on Craigslist posted for musicians. Mm-hmm. What, can you tell us the story about how you ended up with Strumbellas?
Yeah. You know, I grew up playing violin, mostly classical and some fiddling here and there. But I was just kind of sick of that, but looking to keep playing music. And I stumbled on an ad that Simon had posted on Craigslist. And it linked to his MySpace account at the time. And
this is a while ago.
Yeah, it's a while ago. We're dating ourselves. It had a couple songs up on there. So I responded to that along with maybe six other people. And we all met at Simon's apartment in Toronto and got to know each other. And over time, some people came and some people went. And there's only two of us left from that original Craigslist ad. But that's how we formed initially.
Do you remember what it was like the first time you jammed with the band?
Yeah, I remember there was I remember being greeted at the door by Simon, and Simon says, I don't know, maybe my name's Izzy. It was kind of ambiguous. He expected me to be a guy with like a big afro, and I showed up and there I was. So, and then we were all seated in Simon's apartment on couches, jammed in there, 10 or 11 of us. Working through his songbook and trying out different songs and seeing what worked.
That's where it began. Well, let's listen to another track. This one is called Sailing. Before we do, though, Simon, what's going on in Sailing?
It's actually, I can't say. It's a strange thing to say, but it's actually about something really weird that I'm going to take with me to the old grave. So, sorry, I don't have a better answer.
You're pleading the fifth on this
I should have said that. I'm pleading the fifth.
Well, the song should speak for itself. We're going to listen now to Sailing. And this one, you can hear the pop in it, but there's always, you know, the element of roots, it seems like, in your music. And you also do a lot of that with your voice, I notice. Sometimes you just, you kind of whoop it up. You give a whoop. And it's...
I love the whoop.
Should I ask you to do it on the radio? Will you whoop for us?
I'm pretty shy.
It has to be in context.
I'm pretty shy, yeah.
Sorry. All right, well, we'll have to listen. There might be one later on that we can hear. But how do you get that root sound in your music with your voice?
To be honest, I don't think it's a premeditated thing. It's just you sing and you know, you put everything you can into it, and it just kind of comes out the way it comes out. And I'm not exactly what you'd call a planner, so I kind of go on the seat of my pants.
Is that the kind of music you loved growing up? Did you listen to roots music?
No, I was a hip-hop fanatic. I was in a hip-hop band all throughout high school, and I literally only listened to Wu-Tang Clan and Tupac. And then I listened to Ryan Adams one day when I was like 23 out for a jog, and then I just completely changed face to that style of music, that, you know, pop
really?
Country.
So that was the conversion moment.
It was. I remember I was jogging. It was a song, Easy Plateau, by Ryan Adams off of... Cold Roses, and then as soon as I heard that song, I completely just kind of left hip hop and went to alt country music for the rest until today.
Crazy. So you never looked back? That was it?
Never looked back. I mean, I still dabble in the hip hop, but you know, it's this type of music pretty much floored me. So
does this feel more like who you are?
Yeah, considering I was in a hip hop group called Clip Squad, as in the gun clip of a squad, I didn't think that was necessarily, you know, who I was.
That wasn't
considering
silent.
I don't think I've ever seen a gun in my entire life, so I thought this probably was a bit more fitting for who I am, yeah.
Well, you guys just won a Juno Award. This is a really big deal in Canada. Americans may or may not know about this, but what was it? What was it like winning that award, Isabel?
It just really took us by surprise. We had been nominated the previous year, and we were just really thrilled to be nominated against other bands that we really admire. And so when we went the second year, we already knew the feeling of being there and losing. So when we went and we won, we were all just, I don't know, just to have that support of the community and musicians and people in the industry, it's just a great feeling.
And I cried like a baby.
Yeah, Simon cried.
I couldn't even say my speech. Yeah, I don't know why. I'm not a crier. I don't know why that happened.
He got like one line into the acceptance speech and had to pass on the mic.
That and Lion King are the only two times I've ever cried in my entire life.
I hear you on Lion King. I was a mess at Lion King too. Well, what was it about that moment, do you think, that did it? Do you look back, or was it just something that went?
The truth is, it's because my dad always dreamed about being a successful musician, and he passed away a while ago, and I pretty much am doing this, you know, to kind of have this weird void, and so I think that was just a big moment for me, for him.
That's interesting. There's a song in here, and I wish I could remember which one it was. I don't have your CD in front of me. That sounds like it's written to your dad. Are there songs to your dad on this album?
Yeah, a lot of it. One especially, the last song, is literally about him, and other ones kind of tie into it, you know. It all kind of is a bit about it, but you know, that one's like directly, you know.
Yeah.
About it.
And so here you are in Wisconsin. You're playing tonight. And you, Isabel, you said earlier that this is the kind of the furthest south you've been, or something like that. How is this tour going in the States?
Well, it's day one, so far so good. We just left Toronto yesterday, and then we're out, and it's great. We're going all over the country. We're basically circling the country, all the way down to Texas and across down California, and then we'll come back across Canada. So we've toured in Canada so much, it's fun to have a new adventure.
Well, I wish you well, and we're going to go out with a song called Ride On. Simon, any words about this?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so. Sorry, I plead the fifth again.
All right, this is a song called Ride On by the Strumbellas. Here it is.
Lightning bolt is burning holes through my skin to my soul. And I don't try, I try not to sin. But Lord, I'm down, well, I'm down again.
And we've been talking with Simon Ward and Isabel Ritchie. They're members of the Canadian band The Strumbellas. They're playing tonight in Fishburg at True Coffee at 8 o'clock.
We get an update on the race for governor here in Wisconsin. There have been a lot of election-related headlines lately.
The American Civil Liberties Union just filed an emergency appeal against the state's voter ID law. 3-panel judge A panel of three judges, rather, decided last week that the law should be implemented 50 days before the election. Meanwhile, two top Republican officials are suing election officials about the redesign of Wisconsin's ballot. And the latest Marquette Law School poll shows Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke are tied in the race for the next Wisconsin governor.
That's a lot to digest. Here to break down this news and discuss how it could affect the November election, we have Mordecai Lee. He's a professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, let's start with those latest Marquette Law School polls out yesterday. Governor Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke, wait for it, effectively tied. We're still in this deadlock situation. No surprise there, I imagine.
Well, on the one hand, you could say this is a same old, compared to the Marquette polls of the last couple of times around. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Charles Franklin, Professor Charles Franklin, said that there was a discernible increase in enthusiasm by Republicans compared to Democrats, which might be a key signal.
Right. So that's as they measure that in the poll by asking, how likely are you to vote? And that saw an uptick among Republicans this time around.
Right. And I think maybe this is an indication that we're returning to normal, not the new normal, but the old normal. Generally speaking, in Wisconsin politics, you have a higher turnout in a presidential race than you have in the midterm elections. And that the lower the turnout, the more it skews Republican, or conversely, the higher the turnout, the more it skews Democratic. So it could be that what Charles was picking up on is that if Democrats turn out at a midterm level instead of at a presidential level, then it's advantage Republicans.
And people are looking back to the Baldwin-Thompson Senate race, where there were some early signs of higher than expected enthusiasm among Democratic voters in that race. Some people doubted it, but it seems to have panned out. Is that an encouraging sign for Republicans, discouraging sign for Democrats?
You know, Charles is a fabulous pollster. I mean, he really is the gold standard. And so I think we should take it at face value. But on the other hand, what you could say about the Baldwin-Thompson race is that there was a presidential race going on at the time. There was enthusiasm. It turned out that Wisconsin went for Obama. So you wouldn't necessarily say that the result, that just focusing on the polling about the Senate race indicated everything.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be seeing those polls, I think, every couple of weeks now between now and Election Day. So we'll have more grounds to talk about that. But in other news out this week, two Republican leaders sued election officials yesterday over changes to Wisconsin's ballot, saying, in effect, the way they're laid out helps Democrats, kind of hides Republicans. Is this a big story, do you think, or is this just some minor pre-election weirdness?
Well, after an election, when the results are close, one always looks back and says, hey, that was really important, or hey, that was really unimportant. I think in this case, Republicans are following their self-interest in the same way the Democrats would follow their self-interest in terms of not wanting voter ID to be in effect. Republicans feel that this gives an ever so slight advantage to Democrats. And therefore, the scenario they're fearing is a really close election result, so close that maybe it was determined by the redesign of the ballot. When you're in politics, the last thing you want is you wake up the morning after the election and you sort of say to yourself, darn, why didn't I do X? Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, the Republican leadership is saying, we don't want to say, darn, why didn't we do X? We want to do this preemptively.
Well, everybody, I think, thinks back to the famous butterfly ballot in the 2000 presidential elections that may have swayed a presidential election. Do you think that there's a realistic chance that this minor difference could really turn the election one way or another?
Gosh, you know, it really depends if it's a close election or not, and we really don't have the vaguest idea. For example, if we talk about voter ID, Judge Edelman, in his district-level ruling, estimated that there were 200 or even 300,000 Wisconsinites who didn't have a photo ID and didn't have the documentation to get it. Mm-hmm. Now, take, you know, let's say 200,000 people. In the last governor's election 4 years ago, about 2 million people in Wisconsin voted. So if 200,000 people are suddenly not going to vote or suddenly are going to vote, then you've got a really decisive result. On the other hand, if you have a close election, then it definitely would go to the courts, although not necessarily the way Florida went.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's a lot going on here for the Government Accountability Board and local municipal and county clerks to deal with for Election Day. A possible change in ballots kind of in the 11th hour here if this lawsuit is successful. And you mentioned voter ID, trying to implement that. We had Kevin Kennedy, head of the Government Accountability Board, saying, "We think we've got it under control, the voter ID part, but we're kind of scrambling. There's still a lawsuit in the works on that." Is this a recipe for trouble, do you think? Will we see some difficulties at local voting precincts?
I think this is a recipe for trouble. I think it was 2 years ago in Ohio that there was some legal fight. I can't remember if it was about the hours or something like that, but it was a legal fight where the Republican Secretary of State wanted to take it, I believe, to the U.S. Supreme Court the week before the presidential election. This is all really bad for the electorate. What elections administration officials need is certainty and stability. I think as it is, our election administration is really fragile because we have permanent personnel like a county clerk or a city clerk. But on the other hand, the real frontline administrators of an election are citizen volunteers. It's frankly amateur hour in elections. And if you think about getting new directives about how to register people or what documents they have to show, to try to train a couple thousand people who only do this twice a year, that's a real formula for disaster. So It would be better all around if we had stability and predictability.
We'll get into that a little more, but I want to go to a caller now at 800-642-1234 since we've touched on voter ID. John joins us now in Windsor. John, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, Professor Lee, in the past where voter ID has been implemented in states like, for instance, Pennsylvania, there was an increase. I believe that Philadelphia had 98% the turnout in low-income communities in the last election after voter ID. Do you think that this may actually backfire on the Republicans, and this may increase voter turnout with this ruling because people really don't want to see their rights taken away, and if they're not taken away, they ignore them. But when they try and take away these different kind of things, that might actually increase the turnout.
Thanks a lot, John. Mordecai, a backlash driving up turnout after voter ID.
I like John's point, and I think the correct answer to his question is flip a coin. In other words, could it happen that there would be a backlash that he described and that, let's say, Democrats will have a higher than average turnout? Yeah, but it's equally possible that it'll be exactly the scenario that Republicans are predicting, and that's that it'll discourage turnout, especially the more casual voter, the presidential voter.
Well, the big question here, since it's such a close race, and you and I have talked about this before, Mordecai, is what are the parties going to do? What are the candidates and the outside groups, for that matter, going to do to get their side to turn out and the other side to not to?
Rob, I think that is the central question. And in fact, one might say that the key to winning the election is going to be who has the better ground game and, conversely, who has the better voter suppression game. I'm not sure. For example, the Obama campaign did a fabulous job of grassroots organizing and getting their voters to vote 2 years ago. But on the other hand, this is a midterm election, and so Republicans have the advantage. And as the poll results showed, Republicans have the enthusiasm. So in a sense, I guess the only answer I can give you, Rob, is that's why we still hold elections, mm-hmm. because it's so unpredictable what will happen.
And you mentioned that Obama voter turnout. Has the Obama campaign and the people who worked with it, have they been sharing what they did with, say, state Democratic parties and candidates to where they can mobilize in similar ways to the presidential campaign?
I think the answer is yes. Presumably they're sharing information. They've got consultants who have done this before. But on the other hand, the learning curve by the Republicans would be just as steep. They learn from Democrats just like they learn from Republican campaign tactics. So in that respect, it's a kind of an arms race. Who's ahead of the other in terms of organizing, social media, the latest technologies? But to me, the key thing is that For somebody who only votes once every 4 years, and let's say hypothetically we're talking about an African-American voter, although that's not the typical profile of a presidential voter, but if you're an African-American and you were especially proud of President Obama and you really, really wanted to vote, but you otherwise didn't vote that often, then is that demographic less likely to vote for Mary Burke and less likely to go to the polls? In a sense, the answer to that question is going to determine who the next governor is.
We're talking to government and politics expert Mordecai Lee of UW-Milwaukee about a lot of news this week on the race for governor here in Wisconsin.
And you can join our conversation. What do you make of all this election news? How do you think things are going to play out in November? And who do you think will be the next governor of Wisconsin and why? Do you think the voter ID law will be in place at the election? And are you a little bit worried that maybe the election is going to play out in the courts? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us email to talk@WPR.org. We're picking up our discussion about the latest news in the gubernatorial election with Mordecai Lee of UW-Milwaukee.
We're taking your calls now. What is your prediction for the November election in Wisconsin? Who do you think is going to be our next governor and why? And what's the point spread going to be? Do you anticipate having to show your photo ID to vote? How do you feel about that? And do you think this race is going to end up in the court, no matter what side wins or sort of wins? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@WPR.org. So, Mordecai, you touched on this briefly earlier. How likely do you think this nightmare scenario is? It's a really close race, and we start seeing lawsuits over how voter ID was applied, how the ballots were served, and all this sort of thing. And it could drag out for a while.
It could drag out for a while. Hypothetically, you could have a court decide to have a new election. That's very, very rare. But ending up in court is not rare. I think some people up in the Northwest remember when Al Franken ran for U.S. Senate, and it was such a close result, and there were such contested ballots that it ended up in court. And then after some extensive court proceedings, finally the Republican withdrew and conceded the race. But he only won by, gosh, what was it, less than 100 votes. So one could imagine that. There was also another time when there was a U.S. Senate race, I think it was in New Hampshire, that was so close that they decided to have another election. But still, that's pretty, pretty rare.
I think there have been local elections in the state, smaller elections, that have ended up in a coin toss, if I'm not mistaken. That's probably not going to happen in the race for governor.
You know, I like your point, Rob, because hypothetically, could there be a tie in a race for governor? Yes, of course there could be. Is it likely, just based on the random odds of 2 million people voting, to be an exact tie? No, that's pretty unlikely. I think we're going to know who the next governor is without flipping a coin.
Do you anticipate the parties, you know, lawyering up and having observers at polling stations in districts, say, where they expect high turnout for the other side?
I'll tell you what I fear. I fear that going to vote in some of these sort of contested precincts is going to be like getting into the airport. You know, you're stopped by one person, and then you show this, and then you're stopped by another person, and then you show that, and then somebody challenges your third thing. I really think, as a person who believes in democracy, you know, with a small d, I don't think that going to vote should be as hard as getting into an airport. I think we want to encourage turnout. But unfortunately, both parties see advantages in high versus low turnout. And so it's become a partisan issue instead of a kind of a democracy issue.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Steve on the line in Eau Claire. Steve, hi.
Hi. I would like some information that tells me I'm wrong. But basically, I've been mad about this voter suppression situation with voter IDs since over a year ago when I started hearing about it on a national level. And it seems to me that we missed the boat, we being the Democrats, of being the good guys, addressing the fact that nearly half the electorate wants voter IDs, or at least the Republican side is pushing for voter IDs. Even if they don't represent 50% of the people from the Republican cause that are pushing for voter IDs are challenging voter suppression. Why can't we come up with an agreement that voter IDs are necessary? We will help people that need assistance, and pay for it if we need to with donations. They can go to any Democratic headquarters in any location and get the help they need to get the ID they need to vote. Hmm. By that tactic, we would be the good guys. The voter IDs would be out there, and voter suppression would not succeed. Instead, we dragged our feet and put it into the courts and are fighting to the last minute. Tell me I'm wrong about this.
Well, representing a Democratic perspective, I think you've accurately summarized it. But if we talk about the two parties seeking a kind of a public opinion advantage, I think that there's no doubt the Republicans have won the spin race, that Republicans have more sort of forcefully and adamantly talked about the need for integrity in elections, the need for every vote to be counted accurately. And I guess my own personal opinion is that Democrats have not done as good a job on the other side.
And I believe in that Marquette poll we were talking about earlier, a larger percentage of the populace supported voter ID laws than were going to vote for Republicans. So it seems like they may have won that that messaging war, at least to that extent.
Right. And I think it was about 61% said they saw absolutely nothing wrong with voter ID. You know, presumably that's a kind of a middle class kind of perspective on life, whether we're talking about middle class Republicans or middle class Democrats. And I think sometimes it's hard for us to sort of put ourselves in the shoes of people who are on the margins of society. I don't know, a little old lady who lives in a rural area, has stopped driving, never needed a driver's license. The poll workers have known her for 50 years. She's confused. How does she get, a voter ID? So the bureaucracy of life, in a sense, is stacked in favor of the middle class and against the more marginalized populations, whether we're talking about age, whether we're talking about income, whatever the socioeconomic difference might be.
Steve, thanks for the call. We'll go to Craig now in Heartland. Craig, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. To answer your first question, I believe that Governor Scott Walker is going to be reelected. And my main reasoning for it is this. I believe that for the remaining 8% of Wisconsin voters that haven't made their mind up yet, I believe that they're going to vote him back in simply due to the fact that the economy is doing well, unemployment is at a very, very low rate, and typically incumbents are reelected when the economy is doing well. They're usually voted out when we're in the depths of recession. So I think the economy itself is going to reelect Governor Walker.
Craig, thanks a lot for the call. Your thoughts on that, Mordecai?
I like that Craig talked about usually. In other words, what is the norm of Wisconsin politics or American politics? And he summarized it absolutely accurately. The question is, if Wisconsin politics have been so transformed by Act 10 that there's a new normal as opposed to the old normal. For example, right now, based on the Marquette poll, there are about 5% of the people are undecided who they're going to vote for. In Craig's scenario, they break Republican, but I think one could just as easily make an argument about a scenario that they break Democratic. I'm glad we hold elections because that will be the end of that argument.
Thanks, Craig. We'll go now to Bill in Madison. Bill, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the show. My comment is this, that I don't think either party really minds the voter ID law, because what both parties fear is a big turnout of the idiot vote, which could really sway elections and could sway elections in the not too far distant future.
Bill, thanks. I'm guessing the party chairs will not be expressing it in terms of an idiot vote, Mordecai, but do you think that they do live in fear of some kind of random fringe votes swaying an election?
Well, maybe that's why I got elected to the state legislature. Bill is really getting to the heart of a very serious intellectual discussion about democracy. After all, we have to remember that when America declared independence, the only people who could vote were white men who owned property. And that was almost like a ban on an idiot vote, to use his parlance, that if a white male owned property, then theoretically they were sort of viable citizens. They were participating in society fully. So, sure, the more you expand the electorate, the more you're getting to let's call them casual voters or less motivated voters. But I guess I'm old-fashioned. I'd rather expand the electorate and have more people voting and feeling that they have a stake in democracy than fewer.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. So There are two ways, I think, to look at politics in Wisconsin. It's gotten divisive. It's turning people away. It's raising cynicism. Or people are energized and excited and see important things at stake here. And that's maybe a positive, and the first view is negative. Where, how do you weigh those two against each other, Mordecai?
Rob, can I say as my answer, yes? In other words...
No waffling.
I'm a former politician. But, Rob, you really did put your finger on it in the sense that both of those things that you described exist. And it's almost like which of those things is going to end up determining the result. And, you know, I don't have the vaguest idea. We're in totally uncharted territory, which I guess that's why democracy is exciting.
Mordecai, thanks as always for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
That was Mordecai Lee. He's professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. It's our regular Share Something segment. This week, we're checking out some novels set in the world of academia. There's some new stuff and an old classic that's getting a revival.
Anne Strainchamps joins us now. She's host and producer of WPR's national show, To the Best of Our Knowledge. Anne, it's great to have you here.
Hi, Veronica. Great to be here.
Well, you, like Steve Paulson, are a huge reader, and I know that when you recommend a book, I kind of take that as gospel. So this week, you've got some books that center around university life. This kind of novel's got kind of a long tradition, doesn't it?
I am a huge fan of the college novel, and I've been collecting them for years. I think the college campus is a perfect setting for a novel because, you know, it's a small, closed community. It's kind of like setting a novel in a small town or an office, this perfect little stage set. And also, academic life offers just such wonderful characters, fodder for comedy and satire. You know, campus is full of eccentric professors, weird students, backstabbing and departmental intrigue, and all with a background of great books and beautiful ivy-covered walls.
And your first pick is it's an older one, right? That's kind of getting a second wind now. It's called Stoner. Tell us about that
one. Yeah, an old book that's new again. So Stoner is a forgotten classic by a guy named John Williams. It was out of print for a really long time and recently re-released, and it's kind of developing something of a cult following. And I'm going to let you hear about it the way I first did from writer Steve Almond in a segment on To the Best of Our Knowledge.
My name is Steve Almond, and the book I want you to read as soon as... Actually, you could actually be reading it while I'm talking to you. It's that good, and I'm that boring. It's a novel called Stoner. It was given to me many years ago by a friend of mine, and I can tell you that I thought it was about something very different from what it actually turns out to be about. The book is not actually about any kind of drug-fueled exploits. It is maybe the quietest and most restrained book I've ever read. It's about a man named William Stoner, and the first couple of paragraphs essentially announced to the reader that he was an academic, studied medieval literature, and he taught for many years at the same school. He did not go off to World War I and become a war hero. He was not involved in any major intrigue. He's mostly a forgotten figure. He's a forgotten figure to his colleagues and his students. They don't think about him at all. It's the strangest opening to a novel I've ever experienced, and it's also completely hypnotic.
And that is the journalist and writer Steve Almond talking about your first pick, an older book called Stoner. Why is Steve Almond and other people sort of keying in on this older book right now?
Well, I've wondered about that. And I think it's a classic and deceptively simple novel. It's the story of this one man's life. You know, William Stoner, I guess it's an old-fashioned life he lives, really. You could call it, by today's standards, a small life. It's not especially exciting. He's not famous. He never achieves acclaim or genius, and he doesn't expect that either. He has an unhappy marriage. He has this short kind of life-giving affair. He's unfairly accused by a colleague and then spends decades out of favor in his department, and then he, you know, dies as quietly as he's lived. He's a very quiet, a deeply honorable, deeply admirable man. And I think, you know, today it's such a contrast to the kind of lives we often tell stories about or even aspire to live today. Lives that are big, glamorous, filled with success and fame and fortune, right? Well, William Stoner lives the exact opposite, an old-fashioned, quiet life in which he tries to be of service. And the novel shows you just how really beautiful that is. It's completely captivating and very subtle. And yeah, I really love the novel, and I'm happy to see it getting so much renewed attention.
And so that's an older one. Contrast then with a newer pick in that same genre. This one is Dear Committee Members by Julie Schumacher.
Julie Schumacher, who teaches just, you know, north of Wisconsin, teaches creative writing and literature at the University of Minnesota. So this is a classic academic satire. It's also about an embittered middle-aged English professor, Jason Fitker. He teaches creative writing and literature at Payne University. And I'm sure that pun is intended. It's a small college in the Midwest. He's facing the usual budget cuts and the bureaucratic, you know, kerfuffles. Jason once dreamed of writing a great American novel, and his writing career has tanked. And like a lot of academics today, he is besieged by requests for letters of recommendation. He gets just endless requests from his current and former colleagues. And the novel is told entirely in the form of these letters that he writes, which are these little masterpieces of caustic wit and grumpiness.
Oh, let's hear one.
Okay, here's one. This is one of my favorites. Dear Ms. Ingersoll, this letter is intended to bolster the application to Wexler Foods of my former student, John Lisinski, who completed the junior-senior creative writing workshop 3 months ago. Mr. Lisinski received a final grade of B, primarily on the basis of an 11-page short story about an inebriated man who tumbles into a cave and surfaces from an alcoholic stupor to find that a tentacled monster, a sort of fanged and copiously salivating octopus, if memory serves, is gnawing through the flesh of his lower legs, the monster's spittle burbling ever closer to the victim's groin. Though chaotic and improbable, even within the fantasy horror genre, the story was solidly constructed. Dialogue consisted primarily of agonized groans and screaming. The chronology was relentlessly clear. Mr. Lisinski attended class faithfully, arriving on time, and rarely succumbed to the undergraduate impulse to check his cell phone for messages or relentlessly zip and unzip his backpack in the final minutes of class. Whether punctuality and an enthusiasm for flesh-eating cephalopods are the main attributes of the ideal Wexler employee, I have no idea. But Mr. Lisinski is an affable young man, reliable in his habits and reasonably bright. You might start him off in produce rather than seafood or meats. Whimsically, Jason T. Fitker.
That's really funny. I'm sure the rundown of the octopus will help with his job prospects.
Wow. Right, so Julie told us that she herself writes over 100 letters of recommendation a year. And honestly, after reading this book, I cannot imagine anyone having the courage to ask her for one again.
So that one's got, obviously, the trademark biting humor. And so she's a writing professor at Minnesota, you said. Mm-hmm. Seems like there are a lot of Midwestern professors of writing about being Midwestern professors of writing. There was Julie Chang, I think, from the University of Iowa workshop a while back.
Oh, yeah.
Lori Moore
that.
From Wisconsin used to write about that as well. Why do you think it's always so interesting to people, or at least to the writers?
Well, what's the old advice you're given? Write what you know, right? Mm-hmm. And honestly, with the way MFA programs are expanding, like, is there anybody who doesn't want to write a novel? So, I mean, it's such a rich world. And I think going back to what I said originally, you know, these are anytime you can find a small subculture, a pocket of people who exist in isolation and, you know, have that isolation breeds very rich and often very amusing human relationships. So I think it's just all good fodder.
And a last one here is definitely one I think I want to read. It's called Fangirl. Tell us about Fangirl.
Right. Well, so here's where we switch it up. This one is not about academics or not about professors. It's about a student. And it's probably technically a young adult novel, but I mean, I loved it. So it's by Rainbow Rowell, and it's about an undergraduate, a girl named Kath, who's off to college for the first time, along with her twin sister. And Kath is the fangirl because she writes fan fiction. And the fiction she writes is specifically about Simon Snow, who is the hero of a best-selling series of children's books about a young magician and his friends at a private school who have to rescue the world from an evil overlord. Is this sounding familiar?
No, not
right, so clearly this is Harry Potter. So fan fiction is Kath's whole world. And you gradually realize over the course of the novel that she uses the characters she writes about as a replacement for friends and for the real world. And she's built up a huge following online. But now she's an undergrad in a huge university. She's coping with a scary roommate, a guy she likes but can't talk to, a guy she can talk to but doesn't realize she more than likes. You know, it's a coming-of-age novel and a coming-out-of-her-shell novel. And Kath does bloom over the course of the year, but she goes through some rocky times and struggles to make friends and to trust them.
So that's a YA one. Do you have to know Harry Potter to be in on the joke?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. And I think I think so many people are familiar with that kind of fan world these days, whether it's Harry Potter or the Twilight novels or Game of Thrones or whatever, that we really get that world that she's part of. And really, is there anybody who hasn't heard of Harry Potter?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know people who are holdouts who refuse to read it on principle, but I think at least, yeah.
Well, even those people who see the films.
Probably.
Right.
Yeah. So you said that one is personal for you somehow.
Oh, it's personal. So I really love it. I just dropped my daughter off at college for her freshman year, you know, packed her and her Harry Potter posters up. And so that really kind of hit home. I mean, she's definitely written fan fiction, but also, I think every mother wants to wishes she could get a peek of what her daughter's life will be like. And I hope my daughter's life in college is easier than Kath's, but it lets me feel like I get a tiny window onto her life. And I also left the book with her so she could read it while she's there.
You can discuss it when she comes back over the holidays. So in terms of things that really grab you about these college novels, are there others in the genre that you can go back further and look at? I remember Jane Smiley wrote some.
Yeah, Jane Smiley did. A lot of my favorites are the funny ones. So, and by the Brits, who I often think British humor, there's just nothing like it, right? So David Lodge wrote a whole series. He was an English professor, maybe still is, wrote a whole series set in academic departments in Britain and the U.S. with, you know, scheming academics and who are having crazy affairs with each other and also, you know, trying to skewer each other's careers in the process. And let's see, the classic, classic one that everybody should read is Kingsley Amis's Lucky Jim, which is... it's about a hapless undergrad, or maybe he's a graduate student at Oxford, I think, and it's just a complete comedy of errors. This is the kind of guy who's, you know, he walks down the street and chaos follows behind him and he's oblivious to it all. And then there's Robertson Davies in Canada, who was master at Massey College at the University of Toronto and wrote a wonderful series of books called the Cornish Trilogy, set in those ivy-covered walls.
Well, you really do like these college novels.
Yeah, I have a whole shelf of them
at
home.
Off six more novels. Well, that's great because I'm between books right now. And just before we leave, you actually got to talk to Julie Schumacher, right?
Oh, she's great. She's very funny.
To the best of our knowledge.
Yes, for to the best of our knowledge. And I can't give you an actual air date, but if you check the TT Book webpage, we'll let you know when we're going to get it on.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing these. And now I've got some stuff to read again.
My pleasure. Thank you both very much.
That was Anne Strainchamps, host and producer on Wisconsin Public Radio's To the Best of Our Knowledge. And by the way, you can catch To the Best of Our Knowledge right after Central Time, Monday through Thursday at 6 o'clock on the Ideas Network.